Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Age of Bronze by Jez Caggio, narrated by Neil Heligers. Prologue. Chris sprinted down the back street and out into the woods, grunting as the tins inside the bag on his shoulder banged and clattered, bouncing against each other and declaring to all the goddamn world that he had something worth fighting over. Food. It was insane that people were already fighting over tins of food. The bar, which was rapidly falling away behind him, was the sight of a dozen people fighting for the supplies in its restaurant kitchen. As he ran, a scream of pain rang out behind him. He faltered in his run, half turning to glance back. A massive man was laying about him with a menacing length of steel pipe. The other looters ran for it. Now the bouncer was back, the distraction having failed to keep him away long enough. The little nebulous alliance of hungry people broke up, racing in all directions as the massive ex-bouncer of the river bar commenced beating the slowest among them to death. Chris swallowed hard, hesitating as every instinct in his body screamed at him to go help the man on the floor, but even as the pipe rose and fell, blood spraying, he knew he was too late and too weak. He cursed again and turned, sprinting deeper into the woods, away from the buildings. It had been like this for weeks now. The first few days after the end of the world were weird. People generally just sort of laughed and made jokes about struggling on as they complained about missing TV shows and microwave dinners, takeaways, and meaningless sex with people from nightclubs. Well, he had certainly missed that last one at least. By the time a few more days had passed, it became obvious that things were more tense. The good-natured ribbing that marked the first few days became snapping instead, and warning people away from your house, keeping the curtains and blinds closed, the doors locked. By the beginning of the next week, there were constant fights as people realized the world wasn't getting back to normal anytime soon. The local police were guarding the supermarket and handing out food to those who came, provided you showed ID and you could prove you lived nearby. You got one small bag of food and an admonition to make it last as long as possible. Then, the muggings got worse. Princess Anne Park in his hometown of Washington, the original UK one, not the American one, had always had a bad reputation for violence at night. Warnings about not using the park after dark and so on were normal. The gangs started to hang out there, mugging people who tried to take food home, and the police refused to leave the supermarket to stop them. Things went downhill fast. The gangs grew bolder. Knowing that the police couldn't leave the supermarket, they started looting smaller shops. Assaults and rape became common, and the police finally accepted that they had to respond to it, and they tried to arrest the biggest gang, leaving the supermarket and moving out in force. It had been a huge mistake. They'd gone out with the intention of arresting the gangs, of giving warnings and telling blokes off, maybe of having to beat a few more aggressive individuals up, but that was it. The gangs weren't so restrained. The police were ambushed and killed to a man. The 30 or so officers, along with four armed and heavily geared riot officers, lasted bare minutes against the hundreds of idiots carrying a grudge against them, most of them violent criminals who'd escaped custody or gotten off with stupid sentences as the prisons were too full. Then the looting really started. Thousands descended on the shopping center. The five large supermarkets police had been carefully doling the food out from were stripped bare. The shopping center itself was declared one gang's territory, and an impromptu gang war broke out, leaving dozens more dead. People took whatever food they could get, the gangs feeding only their own or those who worked for them, be that in service or exchanging sexual favors for the food. The main gangs merged and warred until they'd entrenched themselves in an impromptu fiefdom. In less than 2 weeks, the town had gone from a happy little place to a war zone, with more than half the population dead. Then, the creatures started roaming, and even more disappeared by the day. At first, it had been sightings, mainly. Things glimpsed out of the corner of the eye, abnormally large rats, cats that acted weird, or dogs that went feral suddenly. The first few days were hard, as people learned that the animals they'd loved all their lives were now dangerous. People decided they couldn't risk it and either put their pets down or turn them out. Roaming packs of dogs, cats by the dozens that fought all night long and worse, filled the streets. The territorial wars clearly weren't limited to humanity, as entire sections of the local area became overrun with feral packs that would attack as soon as look at you. Between the beasts, as many people came to call the changed animals, to differentiate them, and the gangs, the streets began to run red with blood. The gang started to go street by street, taking what they wanted, recruiting the prettiest and most handsome, and collecting the food for the vulnerable. Not that half of them could pronounce the word. They were too drunk on stolen booze and power. Chris decided his home wasn't safe anymore and gathered up his gear, moving out into the forest. He had to risk the animals and creatures rather than the gangs, as there wasn't a day that passed without pitched battles somewhere within earshot. Now he'd been living in the forest for a few days. The others who'd seen the signs and either, like him, had always enjoyed camping or had military training and didn't want to be a part of the gangs, declared an uneasy truce. They formed a small community and moved deeper into the forests and onto the old Lord Lambton's country land. The River Bar had been their latest target. Unwilling as they were to attack people, they'd watched the bar for 2 days, making sure that the only person there was the bouncer who'd claimed it, a massive brute of a man. And they'd made their plans. Becky had volunteered to act as the distraction. Young, buxom, and pretty, she deliberately and strategically torn a dirty top to expose a lot more skin than she would ever dare to normally, and she'd gone looking for some bottled water, hanging back well out of reach as she asked for it. The bouncer had made it clear there was only one way she'd get anything from him, and she'd begged and wheedled, keeping his attention, her pale skin drawing the eye as she shifted uncertainly from foot to foot and bounced a little to keep his interest. While she did that, the others had moved in, Benny climbing in through the small window into the kitchen. Even then, it was barely large enough for the skinniest of their number to slide through. Once he'd wriggled frantically into the dark interior, he'd carefully clambered down onto the filth-covered old steel bench before flicking the latch on the kitchen door and letting the rest inside. They'd move quickly, gathering up tins, jars, anything that would keep, that would last well in the forest. It had been going well, the bar's restaurant having been restocked only the day before the fall, until one of the more desperate and idiotic members of the group had decided it was worth the risk to try to grab some booze from the bar as well as food from the kitchen. As soon as he'd entered the bar, he'd tripped on something, knocking stacked containers over, and made enough noise that the pair of massive, mutated dogs the asshole kept in cages started howling and drew his attention. The bouncer guessed then what had happened, made a clumsy grab for Becky, who broke away and ran for it. Then he grabbed his club, and the violence began. He killed two of their number, reducing them to 11, and as Chris ran, his breath whistling in his ears, his heart sank at the clang of the cages being opened. That bastard had locked himself inside and sent the dogs out to get them. Chris changed direction, weaving between the trees, heading to the small creek he'd crossed over on his way there. He slid down the nettle-encrusted bank and splashed into the water before turning and heading upstream as fast as he could. The water was shallow, under a foot in most places, and the creek was only a few meters wide for most of its length. As he ran, panting, he prayed it would be enough. Minutes passed, broken only by the huffing of his breathing as he pushed on, fear slowly lessening as he dared to let himself hope. The first scream rang out within seconds of the dogs being set free. Then it had grown mercifully quiet after that. He moved on, feet growing numb in the narrow stream, but determined to stick to the little creek for a little longer, just in case. He had been hoping the dogs had given up, satisfied with one victim, when a fresh howl rang out all too close, making his guts twist in panic. "Fuck, fuck, fuck," Chris cursed, the words hissing out from between tightly clenched teeth as he picked up the pace. They were closer than he thought. The stream turned a corner, spreading out and deepening in a natural pool, with a high dirt cliffside formed to his left by the undercutting of the bank. He splashed across to the far side, grabbing tree roots and pulling himself up hand over hand until he reached the top of this much higher section. Chris looked back, forcing himself to be silent, and seeing what he'd not heard over the sound of his own panicked breathing and splashing. Movement. A red-checked top, only visible because of the stupid fucking color, appeared through the trees, and now that he was quiet, he picked up both the frantic splashing as Becky used the same trick he had, and the muffled sound of her swearing. "Becky," he hissed, then swore and called again, louder, when she had drawn a little closer. She froze and dropped low, glancing about fearfully. "Up here," he snapped, gesturing frantically. She looked up and saw him, relief making her shoulders sag as she recognized him. Then fear filled her eyes as another howl echoed, closer, swiftly followed by a second scream rising into the air, sounding far too close for comfort. "Carl," she whispered, recognizing the pain and terror-filled voice. Her face drained of color as she glanced behind her, before swallowing and turning back to Chris, following the clear marks that he'd left behind in the dirt. She grabbed at some of the same roots he had, hauling herself bodily up the steeply inclined side before taking his hand and letting him pull her over the top to collapse against him when he fell back. He quickly rolled free of her, reaching out and grabbing her hand, pulling her to her feet. "We can't stop, Becky," he hissed, terrified as much as she was. Lifting his finger to his lips in a gesture to be quiet, he whispered, "We need to get to the old oak tree. You know which one I mean." She nodded, and he went on. "I stashed my gear there. If we can get to it, we can lash ourselves to the upper branches and hide." "Go," she panted, nodding her head. "Let's go." The pair set off again, this time trying to make as little noise as possible as the screams behind them died away. Until they found their scent, the mutated dogs could only hunt by sound, and if they could keep that down, below the level of someone else nearby anyway, they had a chance still. Minutes passed, then more, their hearts finally slowing to a reasonable rate, their breathing still fast but manageable, until Becky suddenly yanked Chris backwards, her other hand slapping over his mouth as she frantically hissed at him to be quiet. He did as she demanded, fear filling him as he watched her eyes. She crouched next to him in the lee of a fallen tree, peering around the edge of a ball of dead roots long since washed clean by the rains. Then her eyes widened, and she nodded forwards. It was hard to see at first as he peered through the roots with her, her hand tightly clenched inside his own, but after long seconds, something moved, and he bit back an oath. It was black and massive. Where the dog's mutations had been one thing, the cat slinking through the trees ahead was terrifying in a totally different way. Faint gray stripes patterned its side, a reminder of what might once been a British tortoise shell. But this beast was at least 2 meters long and a meter high. Its eyes caught the gloomy light and reflected it back as it paused, staring right at them. Then a newel howl somewhere close behind them made them flinch. When they looked back, the cat was gone. And Chris started to panic. "They're too close," Becky hissed. "We can't get to the oak, but we can climb that one." She pointed frantically to a tree a dozen meters away, old and partially dead. One side was gray and had bare branches, while the other was green and healthy. Chris nodded to her, swallowing down his despair. Yes, the tree was big enough for them both, and the lowest branches were probably too high for the dogs to be able to get at them. But that also meant that the branches were too high to get to. "How?" he started. But Becky was already shucking her top off, exposing a mass of tanned and pale flesh that drew the eye and short-circuited the brain. I, he started, unable to look away, until the sharp sting of her slap across his cheek brought him back to the moment. "Your top," she hissed. "Give it to me." He glanced back to where more howls were coming and then back to her, totally bewildered, before giving up and tugging it off. She snatched the double extra-large t-shirt and tied it to hers quickly, along with the small red top and her denim jacket. With a heave, she swung the improvised rope around the back of the tree and caught the other end. She tugged on it hard, making sure it would hold, then leaned back and started to climb, the rope letting her brace against it and practically walk up the tree. It took her less than a minute to reach the lowest branch, and she hesitated, building her courage before letting go of the rope and jumping. Frantically grasping upwards, her fingers sliding across moss and breaking a handful of small twigs and leaves free. She started to panic, fingers scrabbling before two fingers caught a cleft. Becky hissed in pain, swinging out and dangling from the tree. She paused, gritting her teeth and huffing, before swinging her other hand up, getting a better grip. Then she started hauling herself upwards, pulling herself across the main branch, and sagging. Becky sent a triumphant glare down at Chris, who stared open-mouthed up at her.
"What the hell are you waiting for?"
she snarled. He jumped, the lack of more sounds from behind them and the totally unexpected sight of her clambering up the tree so gracefully and so topless had thrown him, and he frantically rushed for the discarded cloth rope. He threw it up to her and she caught it, tying it off and dangling it back over the side, just as the first dog entered the far end of the clearing.
"It's too high," Chris snapped,
the bright red of her top dangling just beyond the reach of his fingers. When Becky didn't respond, he spun, following her gaze. The massive canine was shaggy, the remnants of white fluffy hair showing it had once been one of those yappy bastard dogs, a cocker spaniel or something like it. But now it stood almost as high as a pony, the red staining its muzzle and the bits stuck in its teeth as it bared them, showed it was now a lethal hunter in its own right. Chris took two steps back towards it, then ran at the tree, jumping and kicking off. His arms reached out and grabbed at the clothes, frantically fast roping up them, grabbing Becky's outstretched hand and letting her help to pull him up. The snap of the dog's jaws as they caught the edge of his jeans, almost tugging him free before the fabric ripped, was enough to make him gibber in fear. He scrambled up, Becky already climbing ahead of him, as the pair pulled themselves higher and higher up the tree. The dog thing rolled over and bounded at the tree, snarling in fury as its prey escaped. Leaping up, it snapped at the dangling rope, tearing it and dangling for a few seconds before it gave way and fell, crashing to the ground. It bounded upright again and tore into the clothes, scattering them and tearing them to shreds, before attacking the bag that Chris had dumped when he stripped his top off. The heavy-duty cloth lasted seconds, and the tinned tomatoes, the first of the three tins to tumble out, was bitten into and sent spraying everywhere seconds later. The other two tins were ignored as the beast shook its head from side to side. The tin crumpled around a massive incisor as the dog tried to shake it free, biting down and chewing hard. The pair clung desperately to the tree, exchanging a fearful look, huddling close together as they watched and prayed for a miracle. Minutes passed as the dog howled and dug at its jaw. The howl of the other dog somewhere in the distance made it pause, lifting its head. As soon as it was still, the panting sound of its breathing filled the small clearing, standing under the tree opposite the one Chris and Becky huddled fearfully in. A shadow fell upon it from above. The cat that had vanished before fell like a rock from the tree, slamming into the dog from above, its teeth clamping down hard on the back of the dog's neck even as it raked its claws down its victim's sides in long gashes. The cat's needle-like teeth sank in deep, and the dog went wild, bucking and thrashing around, frantically trying to dislodge the cat before finally sending it crashing into a tree with an audible crunch of bone. The cat collapsed on the mossy floor, laying panting in panic on a bed of roots and dirt, as the dog sagged nearby. Its back legs dragged useless behind it as the dog growled and whined, attempting to drag itself forwards. It tried twice more, then sagged to one side, whimpering. Chris stared down at the two titans of their new world and their sudden vulnerability. Before he could think better of it, he started climbing back down, even as the dog let out a long howl. He was answered a second later from somewhere in the distance. Trembling with fear, Chris dropped the last few meters to the ground, ignoring Becky's hissed questions and accusations of idiocy. He crept closer to the dog, backing up as it thrashed, emitting a low growl, and tried to bite him. "This is for Carl," Chris growled, picking a large rock up and slamming it down atop the dog's muzzle. It howled in pain, trying to back away, but with its back legs broken, it only managed to thrash itself over onto its other side, exposing the back of its head. Chris lifted the large rock overhead and slammed it down again and again, as hard as he could, until the bone shattered with an audible crunch, and the dog grew still. He stood there, over the dead mutant dog, panting, splattered with blood. Then he frowned, confused, as a new screen, much like that of a computer, popped up before him, filling his vision with text. "You have reached level 1. You have 5 stat points to invest. XP required to reach next level? 35 of 100. "You've gotta be shitting me," Chris muttered before blinking the screen away and looking down at the cat, which hissed at him in warning. "Now what?" "You goddamn idiot, Chris," Becky snapped at him, dropping to the ground nearby and picking up a second rock. They glanced at each other, then she passed it to him, and he blanched. "It didn't attack us," Chris started to say, glancing back at it before pausing. There was something of a maddened stare in the cat's eyes and clear paralysis. Reluctantly, he stood up and lifted the rock overhead. He hated doing it. The horrible crunch as he brought it down atop the cat's skull taking him back to a night months ago, when his friend Matt had hit a deer with his car, breaking its back in the same way. He'd pulled over, and the pair of them had gone back to check on it. The poor animal was writhing around, frantic with pain and maddened. Matt had taken a rock and had done what he'd just done, ending its life and putting it out of its misery, but it had been horrible to see. That sudden memory faded, but the thought of his friend stayed. Chris stood, dropping the blood-covered rock to the floor, and turned to Becky.
I'm getting my gear, and I'm going looking for my friend. I don't know if you want to come, but...
He started leading the way in the rough direction he thought the old oak was in.
From the oak?
Becky asked uncertainly. He nodded, sighing in relief as she forced a smile, picking up the remains of his backpack and covering herself with it, and pointed it in a different direction.
You're brave, Chris. Put your shit with directions, mate. You'll probably get lost if I let you go alone.
Thank God. I really don't want to go alone, he admitted, picking up the tins and wondering just what the hell was going to be found between there and Newcastle. Chapter 1. Oh, shit, I muttered, my heart dropping into my boots as I made the connection. They were dungeon creatures, I whispered, just as Mike stepped up beside me, having clambered out of the window.
What does that mean? He asked.
It means we're not alone, Mike. There's another dungeon in Newcastle, and it's probably sent these hunting for us.
Well, shit.
Yeah. Understatement of the fucking century there, mate. I grumbled, trying to make sense of this. First of all, it didn't make much sense for the dungeons to be so close, and then why the creatures were out roaming. Okay, fuck this. I took a deep breath and turned around, the glittering reliquaries popping into view. I couldn't help but grimace at how few of us had survived.
Look, man, just what the hell is going on?
One of the coppers asked me. I blew out a long breath and looked around, seeing the blood dripping from the cars and walls, the small fires, how the entire street looked like it had been used in a Hollywood blockbuster. I winced at the losses that the coppers, who'd come at Mike's request for help, had suffered. The damn goblins at the dungeon they came from had a hell of a lot to answer for, I decided. I raised my voice so the rest of them could hear. This isn't going to be easy to listen to, but you've only got a few minutes before the reliquaries disappear. Anything you killed should have one. Reach out and touch it. Take whatever it offers, even if you don't want it, as otherwise the dungeon gets that mana back. Do that first, then gather the weapons, the ammo, and anything else from your dead, I ordered, suiting words to action as I reached out to the troll. The reliquary was more ornate than my own. The panels that made up the sides of the pyramid were a glittery, starry black, while the edges of the structure were outlined in burnished copper. It hovered above the corpse, slowly rotating, and as I reached out, I got a prompt. Do you wish to loot this reliquary? Yes, no. Not exactly a difficult choice, I grumbled, mentally tapping yes. The side of the pyramid closest to me hinged down, and there was a sudden flare of light from within the shrouded depths. It looked like the reliquary was somehow turned inside out, then a small copper bar floated in the air before me. I reached out, and as soon as my fingers curled around it, the light vanished, and the bar became solid and damn heavy. I grunted, lifting it and looking it over, before smacking it on the wheel arch of the car next to me, getting a satisfying clang.
That car belonged to you?
One of the coppers growled. I snorted, recognizing that, of the four who remained, this was the one who'd followed suit when the other had been intent on killing me, at least until his fellows had stepped in.
No, it doesn't, I admitted, a sarcastic edge to my voice. But considering that electricity won't be coming back, it's an electric car, so I don't think the owner will care, and oh wait, it's been hammered into scrap by a fucking troll.
Matt, Mike admonished in a low voice. I glared at him for a second before pursing my lips in acceptance.
Okay. Sorry.
I forced myself to speak in an even voice as I strode over to the other reliquaries, quickly looting them while I talked.
Look, guys, I'm sorry I'm coming off like a dick here, but I've been fighting shit like this since the fall, and today you buggers show up and start acting like the world was like it was before. Pissed me off a bit, that's all. Okay?
Understandable, but believe me, we've been plenty busy ourselves, one of the coppers said, his voice low.
I picked him out as the one the copper I just killed had called College Boy.
Yeah, bet my weird days beat yours, I mumbled, pocketing a handful of packets of chewing gum and, of all things, a pot of single cream for the next few loot drops.
Look, if you don't want the shit in the reliquaries, that's fine. Take it and dump it. We need it, I said firmly,
We've not got time to stand around and shoot the shit. Wherever these came from, the dungeon will be making more already. After we kill them all, we'll be sending them straight here, I'd imagine, to kill off the threat. We need to grab anything and everything we need or can use, then we need to get the hell out of here. What dungeon? What's sending them? What the hell? The copper started to shout. I'll explain, all right? I'll explain, but we have no time. Strip the dead. I'm sorry that it's not respectful, but we need the weapons, and yeah, I'm looting this fucking shop. You can join in and have some gear that'll help you survive, or you can glare at me, but I'm doing this. As soon as we've got what we need out of here, I'll tell you all I know. I lied. I had no intention of telling them about my dungeon or anything else important, like where the hell we lived. I'd let them know the basics that affected their new lives, because while I might be a dick at times, I wasn't a complete asshole. Mike gathered up the last of his loot from the reliquaries, then stepped across to the body of their sergeant, picking the rifle up that the idiot had taken from him earlier, and checking it over. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" one of the other coppers growled at him. I held up a hand, interrupting the glare that Mike gave him back. "He's getting my goddamn gun back from your sergeant. I fought a gang of gypsies over at Saltwell Park for that. And the other guns I have, you think it's from one of your guys? Might be. All the gypsies told me was that they were taking what they wanted and they killed some of your people," I said, my tone broaching no nonsense. "You lost your claim on the gun when it was used against civilians, and you weren't anywhere to help. I freed the people they had locked up, so if you get any survivors coming from there, you can thank me," I told them as Mike stripped the ammunition and handgun from the body. The coppers watched like kids having their lunch money nicked by bullies. "I'm sorry," Mike said, "but let's be damn clear here. You just fought goblins, trolls, and that." Mike pointed at Jack, who had slinked across to my side and was standing ready for orders. The mechanical dog looked dented, scratched, and generally battered, but intact. "Should be proof enough for you that the world's all gone to shit. You see the size of the dogs the damn goblins are riding?" he asked. I glanced over at the nearby Doberman, and the others tracked my gaze. It looked to have been a handsome example of the breed, well-muscled and clearly well-fed, but it was the small saddle and the fact it was bigger than a Great Dane that stood out the most, though. "The goblins are from a dungeon," I said clearly, gathering up the various weapons I'd dropped or had taken from me, including the stiletto I'd driven into the troll's eye earlier. "The dungeon has to be nearby. There's not been time for it to grow enough for this much to be under its influence yet, so that means it's sending out roving parties to kill anything it can. The dungeon gets mana from each kill these make, and as soon as they die, it can start making more. Think of it like 3D printing things. There's the cost to run it, but the individual items aren't that expensive to make, as long as you have a design, or they weren't, I guess," I shrugged, jogging over to right an overturned wheelbarrow from some roadworks further up the street, and then back towards the shop with it, the coppers following me and listening. "There's no 10 years of growing to get these beasts up to the point that they can fight. It's just print them up from a blueprint, and boom, they can operate. The longer they last, the stronger they become. You're all leveled now, so listen up. Here's the basics, just in case you weren't listening the first time around," I said, clambering in through the broken window and kicking an overturned coat rack out of the way. I grabbed a few thick, heavy-duty coats and tossed them out to Mike as the coppers gathered outside next to him, glancing at each other in uncertainty. They watched him put the coats in the bottom of the wheelbarrow but said nothing, simply clutching their guns and listening. "The leveling system is simple. As near as I can tell, you start out as a zero, and whatever points you have from the way you've lived your life are your own, high or low dexterity, etc. The system isn't complicated, thankfully, but once you reach 10 points of experience, it unlocks the first level, and you get 5 points to invest in yourself. And don't just do what you did, you damn idiot," I said, nodding to one of the coppers, who was visibly straining the seams of his body armor. "Investing in just strength isn't a good idea, or at least it isn't unless you've got a plan. If you're going to be fighting in melee, using a hammer or an axe, yeah, maybe. Using a sword? Nope. You need mainly dexterity and agility. You all know the differences between the various stats, right?" I asked, and got an unsure murmur in reply. "Okay, quick top-down explanation," I said, sighing, passing a trio of compound bows and a fuck-ton of arrows out to Mike. "First of all, do you all understand the concept of strength, agility, and so on as they're commonly used? The higher your strength stat, the stronger you are, right?" "We're not idiots," the guy I mentally tagged as Asshole One said, and I shrugged. Fine, I'll skip all those details then, and fuck you very much when it comes to the nuances. So did anyone level up again through that second round? Pull up your notifications. Just think, notification.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?